Hello, everyone. We're on the margins of Riga Strakom Dialogue 2022, and I'm delighted that today we're joined by a guest from Ukraine, Lyubov Cibulska. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lyubov is founder and the first head of the Center for Strategic Communication and Information Security in Ukraine. She's one of the leading experts on hybrid threats in Ukraine and advisor to the Minister of Foreign Affairs on countering disinformation. So perhaps we could start by taking a broader snapshot and drawing directly on your expertise from Ukraine. Could you tell me the distinction in how Russia targets audiences in Ukraine, maybe more international audiences versus its own domestic audience? Do you see the presence of different narratives when it comes to different audiences? Do you see the presence of varying information warfare tactics with respect to different audiences?
Absolutely. I think that Russia targets different audiences in different ways. First of all, Russia has its own domestic audience, and it works very skillfully. And I think that Russia is the most effective when it comes to Russian audience. Russia is trying to convince and does it pretty successfully again, the Russians, that the whole world is against them, and nurture this sense of resentment, which is very unifying feeling. It is feeling that basically helps them to be united around one leader, dictator. Another audience is Ukrainian audience. And obviously here Russia applies totally different tactics. And it's not about imposing pro-Russian narratives. Russia stopped imposing pro-Russian narratives and building this so-called Ruskiy Mir, Russian world, right, in Ukraine in 2015, 2016. Since then, Russia has been applying a tactic of using internal vulnerabilities. It tries to polarize us.
What kind of vulnerabilities do you mean?
Every gap, every mistake, every controversy we have within our society is taken by Russia. So Russia tries to polarize us, to divide us, to basically distract us on our internal conflicts. That's how they were trying to ruin, you know, civil society, imposing these narratives on Sorosyata, like basically the repetition of Russian narratives about foreign agents. So yeah, every mistake we make is used by Russia and highlighted, but not just for Ukrainians, but for the whole world. And for the Western audience, it's a bit different tactics. It's about using these painful spots of Western societies and telling about Ukraine and making the world look at Ukraine through Russian imperialistic lenses. This is very dangerous because a lot of countries still do not see us as an independent country, do not hear our voice, because they still think that we belong to so-called Russian sphere of influence, which is totally Russian narrative. But I think that Ukrainians made it pretty clear that we do not want to be under Russian rule. We are different, because what Russia is trying to do towards Ukrainian, basically to erase our identity, to say that we do not exist. And that's why we call it genocidal war, because they deny our identity. They want to kill and torture us, and also kill and torture our history, our culture, and our identity, who we are, basically.
And what about the information space in the areas of Ukraine that Russia has managed to occupy, has managed to kind of subject to its military control? Do you see efforts there to kind of integrate those regions into this alternative reality that Putin has constructed in Russia?
Absolutely. The first thing they do when they come and occupy our territories, they ban Ukrainian channels. Mm-hmm. They just switch it off. Ukrainian radio, Ukrainian TV stations, Ukrainian media. And the second thing they do, they bring their television there. And they put these portable, you know, screens and show, you know, Первый канал.
Kind of like this show.
Yes. Yeah. And Первый канал and other Russian TV channels just on the streets. Mm-hmm. Because they know that it works. they know that when person listens to this for some time, then the will to fight of this person will be broken.
Of course, one of the fascinating things about this war is that, unlike in previous conflicts, it hasn't just played out on CNN or BBC. It has played out on social media, on Twitter timelines, Facebook timelines, Instagram stories, even TikTok videos. So the way a Latvian, baker would now find out about what's happening in Ukraine is not really by reading CNN.com, but rather by seeing an Instagram video that a Ukrainian baker has posted about, the destruction that a Russian, artillery shell has done in his village. Can you speak about how this has changed the nature of the information space during the conflict? Has this kind of democratization of who gets to report on what's happening there, has it fostered greater empathy, do you think? Has it led to a greater level of authenticity in the reporting?
First of all, one of the main features of this type of warfare is the importance of observer. So if you look at the history of warfare, you'll see that there were a few generations, and every time when technology changed, there was another warfare. And now with the globalization and with the, social media spread all over the world, we see that this factor of observer became crucial. Observer, which means people, mm-hmm. right? They have their voice. And Russia used it especially skillfully in 2014, 2015, when Russia occupied Crimea. It was just a couple of days before the referendum, mm-hmm. so-called referendum, when Russian security services launched a few groups on social media, namely FSB launched a few groups on ВКонтакте, Одноклассники, and Facebook. And now we know that it was bots and trolls. But at that moment, it looked like, voices of average Crimean citizens. Mm-hmm. And they said we are disappointed in Ukraine, we want to join Russia. And I remember very, vividly how respectful media, credible media would pick those comments and post as real. So Russia basically used this observer factor very in favor of occupation. Now I think that Russia miscalculated that this factor might be in our favor as well, because the whole Ukraine stood up and started, posting and showing the atrocities, showing what Russia actually commits in Ukraine. And of course, it attracts a lot of sympathy, a lot of engagement. So we felt that our voice is heard, which was very important. And but the thing is that, for instance, it doesn't work with the Russians. Like, when we're trying to show them what their military, what their people...
There is this cognitive dissonance, right? Refusing to accept...
They don't want to accept that this is a real world. They live in the world created by Russian propaganda. And that's why Russia brings, Russian television, mm-hmm. Russian TV channels immediately once it occupies our territories. Because they know that it is possible to create this alternative reality with these people and convince them that they live good, they feel okay.
But about these social media platforms that are part of constructing this alternative reality, for example, ВКонтакте, as you said, has this vulnerability really been closed? I imagine there are still thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians that use this platform. Does the Ukrainian government conduct operations on these platforms as well, attempting to counter pro-Russian narratives? Or?
First of all, Russian social media, ВКонтакте, Одноклассники, they are under full control of FSB starting from 2014. And in 2016, Ukraine banned this social media because we witnessed, especially on the first phase of the war in 2014, we saw a lot of operations in influence, how Russia targeted Ukrainian military, their relatives, and the rest of the society. it was just, you know, immense. It was just a very, very powerful. And of course, a lot of Ukrainians had accounts on those social media. But later we realized that we do not have capacity to conduct operations of influence on those social media because they're under control of, you know, the enemy. So now we are trying to interfere. There are some volunteers who do it, but generally I wouldn't say that it is significantly successful, because once you even hack account and post something, truth, it's going to be banned like in 15, 20 minutes. So it's not the perfect platforms for operations, informational operations from our side.
I see. But what I meant to say is, what I meant to ask is about those Ukrainians that are now under the occupation, under the Russian, in the occupied territories. What has been successful in reaching out to them? What can the Ukrainian government do to reach out to its citizens that are now forced to live in these, fake people's republics and so on?
First of all, there is a difference between those who live under occupation since 2014. Donetsk and Lugansk regions, and those who live just 3 months since the beginning of the full-scale invasion. I mean, Kherson, Melitopol, and some other cities. Of course, these people managed to see atrocities Russia committed and commits, and they still have a lot of connections, like personal connections. So they can get some information through phones, sometimes through internet. So we do not see like some significant change in their behavior. They still are very patriotic. They are trying to show resistance, you know, drawing Ukrainian flags, you know, spreading some leaflets. So there is resistance. But again, like if it takes too long, we assume that some of these movements will be oppressed.
I was fascinated to learn, and you alluded to this as well in our conversation earlier, that one specific way in which Russia targets these newly occupied territories in Ukraine is that once the Russian forces move in, the first thing they do is implement censorship, but they also kind of literally target telecommunications infrastructure. They destroy internet and cell towers and so on. And of course, the reason they do this is because by removing free access to internet, they restrict people's ability to document and publish evidence about the atrocities committed there. So there's credible research that literally shows a correlation between access to internet and levels of atrocities committed. What lessons do you think we can garner from this? Of course, you know, we have seen, Elon Musk take the initiative with providing Starlink services, but I mean, clearly this is not enough. So what can Western governments maybe do to ensure provision of internet or work in other directions?
You know, many people ask me, how come that you have internet everywhere, even in bomb shelters? Why do you people post, these terrible pictures, basically, you know, online, it just happened, and now this picture is online. I think that it's an advantage in Ukraine that our internet is not that centralized like in Russia or Belarus, and we have managed to have like a broad network of internet providers, and that's how we managed to be successful during this war in terms of information coverage. But generally, like what lessons learned we can have, I think that first of all, we should defeat the aggressor, and by all means, you know, there is no, like we shouldn't, you know, always look for some small loopholes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a big problem and we have to face it and solve it. Russia is a big problem for the whole world, not just for Ukraine. And now we see how Russia weaponizes this hunger, right? This food issue with the grain, and a lot of countries will be deprived of food because Ukraine is occupied partly. So yeah, I think that we shouldn't just, you know, try to grab some small things. You know, we should finally face that there is a big monster and we have to fight. This is a dragon, you know, this is like our final battle for many of us. I mean, like definitely for Ukraine. And if we do not altogether stop this monster now, then there is no point in looking for this, you know, loopholes when we can have some lessons learned.
Maybe on a concluding thought, as a concluding question, I think that in the West, you can see a maybe a misguided sense of satisfaction, or maybe this sort of dangerous euphoria that, you know, look, we have managed to be united in imposing sanctions. We have managed to mobilize ourselves to send military and humanitarian assistance to Ukraine. And there is, you know, euphoria. Look, Ukraine has, you know, achieved great success on the ground. It has managed to hold Kyiv and Kharkiv and even push back the occupying forces in some directions. But what do you think the West underestimates about this war? Could you maybe speak some unpleasant truths that our audience needs to hear?
Yes, and I think that first of all, we should understand that it's not gonna take, you know, just a few months. We should keep our attention focused on this for some time. And it's not enough, you know, just support Ukraine and, you know, send weapons. It's very important to isolate Russia, to bring her to the point when it cannot finance this war any longer. So we can measure our success only when we defeat Russia. Not just, you know, okay, we send, you know, this weapon or that humanitarian aid and that's it. No, it's not going to happen this way. It's because if Russia finishes with us, it will go further. It's not going to stop. And I can bring you like numbers, I think thousands of examples from Russian propaganda, how it dehumanizes other nations as well and Baltic states as well. So it's not just our problem. Yes, we are very close to Russia. Russia has this resentment towards Ukrainian. But if we lose this war, they will go further.
As you say, this is a long-term challenge. This is not a challenge that can be kind of wished away. You know, you can't choose your neighbors. Russia will always be our neighbor. Do you see any prospects for the long-term deputinization of Russia? Do you see any potential sources of change from within? Or is the only solution a military victory in this war?
Of course, we would like Russians to do their homework and to remove Putin by themselves. I think that Russian civil society completely failed because it was their job to ensure that Russia preserves liberal values and Putin is not going further occupying the power. But they failed, let's admit it. Yeah, I think that sooner or later we have to come to the dialogue with them. And we cannot just defeat them by, you know, military means and then have, you know, joint future next door to them, because it's going to happen again. It's going to repeat again and again if we do not bring them to the realization that they were wrong, that they actually made a huge mistake. And we have to help them to go through this process of re-education of their society and admitting their fault. This is very important. Otherwise, we will have this war again in 10 or 20 years.
Just as a final question, you mentioned supporting Russian civil society. I am you know, proud to say that Latvia, this country, has you know, given shelter to many Russian journalists who have been repressed at home. I'm sure Ukraine has done the same, giving asylum and giving a safe haven to thousands of activists and human rights advocates. How do you see the future of supporting Russian civil society? What sort of investments do we need to make? What sort of support do we need to provide to really meaningfully enable them?
Well, this is a $1 million question, I would say, because what I see, what I observe is that Russian liberal opposition, it's for many Ukrainians, it's almost ridiculous when we call them liberal opposition. But yes, journalists, civil society representatives, when they left Russia, they started advocating lifting sanctions. Mm-hmm. And it means that they haven't managed to see the core of the problem. who now they defend Russian, great Russian culture, which also should be revised because it is very imperialistic, it's very chauvinistic. So I think that they should shift their focus right now. They should focus their attention on those atrocities committed in Ukraine against Ukrainians, but not, you know, defending Tchaikovsky or trying to help Russian soldiers saying that they are just pure victims. It doesn't work this way, because otherwise I see also this tendency with Ovsyannikova, example, Russian Первый канал editor in the past. She had such a warm welcoming in Germany, but she hadn't actually admitted prior to this whole story that she was wrong. And this is very important. They also need some, you know, I wouldn't say re-education, but they should reconsider their position and not fight for Russian liberal opposition, but fight for democracy and liberal values, first of all.
Well, this is certainly a project for multiple generations, perhaps. Thank you so much for joining us. We are very honored to have you here from Ukraine, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.